but it's an important passage for us today. We've been working our way through 1 Kings, and this section is, if you want, the high point of this whole account of Elijah and Ahab in the nation of Israel, the northern kingdom of Israel. The passage begins with what we imagined last week might never happen. If you remember last week, we were told at the beginning of chapter 18 that after 3.5 years of no rain, which had come about because Elijah had said to Ahab back at the beginning of chapter 17, there will be no rain until I say so, because my God is God, not your God, the Baals. Elijah then went away from Israel. There was 3.5 years without rain. Now we're told at the beginning of chapter 18, the word of the Lord comes to Elijah, go and present yourself to Ahab and tell him that there's going to be rain on the land. We had that little discussion, little parenthesis with Obadiah, who was a little bit fearful about being told to go to tell Ahab that Elijah was on the way. But finally, at the beginning of this section, we read in verse 16, Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and then Ahab went to meet Elijah. And when he saw Elijah, he said to him, is that you, you troubler of Israel? It's a great statement, isn't it? And I want to just start an introduction to see that this is all about who is troubling who. There is trouble ahead in this section, but whether it will be trouble for Elijah or whether it will be trouble for Ahab and the Baals, we don't yet know. But Ahab does to Elijah what we so often do. We put the blame on somebody else. So Ahab sees Elijah as the whole problem for Israel. Elijah has said there will be no rain at my word. And so Elijah is the troubler of Israel. And what Ahab, of course, has conveniently forgotten is that the reason that Elijah has said there will be no rain at my word is because, as we read at the end of chapter 16, Ahab has done more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any other king before him. And God had lost patience with Ahab, and he had fulfilled what he had promised way back in Deuteronomy, which was, if you deserted me and went and worshipped other gods, I will stop providing the rain for the land that I provide. And so the answer actually is not that Elijah has just made life difficult for everybody by saying, I'm going to show you how powerful I am, there's no rain. But it is exactly as Elijah says. Verse 18, I have not made trouble for Israel, Elijah replied, but you and your father's family have. You have abandoned the Lord's commands, have followed all the Baals, and you are the problem. Now, it's an interesting take, isn't it, here? Because whatever happens in life, there are always two perspectives we can take. We can always interpret it from a different vantage point. And generally, we tend to interpret it from a vantage point that suits us. That's exactly what Ahab is doing. He's saying, look, Elijah, you're the problem. You're the troubler of Israel. Elijah is saying, no, Ahab, you are the problem. The difference is, of course, that Elijah has God's word and insight about what the real problem is, and Ahab has simply been ignoring what God has said. Now, you and I can be the same. We can so often blame God for situations in our lives that we're frustrated with, or prayers that perhaps aren't answered, or people who are a pain in the neck, or situations at work that we find difficult, or just anything that doesn't seem to go in the way that we would hope it might go. And we can easily say, well, God, look, I didn't sign up for this unpredictable future that you seem to be giving me. I signed up for a future that is all good and sorted and straightforward. And I'm not sure I can trust you unless you make my future sorted and straightforward. Well, here is Elijah saying, well, Ahab, you may have read that slightly wrongly. And actually, you may want to look at yourself before you instinctively blame God. Now, we're going to find out as we go through this that actually the real issue here is not so much Ahab, but it's going to be what the people do when faced with a choice between Ahab and Elijah, or worshipping the Baals or worshipping the Lord. Because let's see what goes on. Because there is a problem here with wavering. Notice what Elijah does next. He says, summon the people from Israel to meet me at Mount Carmel. Bring your 450 prophets. Okay, these ones, and the 400 prophets of Asherah who sat at Jezebel's table. And so Ahab did that. They assembled all the prophets on Mount Carmel. And Elijah goes before them and says to the people, how long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him. And the people said nothing. Why? Well, I guess because Elijah had put his finger on the issue, hadn't he? He had seen exactly what they were doing. They weren't prepared to go for one or the other. They wanted to have their cake and eat it. They wanted to be, at one level, God's people, Israel, with all the promises that that brought of eternity and a land flowing with milk and honey and security and a future. But at the same time, in the present, they wanted to have all that worshipping Baal offered, because following God didn't look to them as if it was delivering, but Baal, in the way that he was being presented, did seem to deliver. Now, Baal offered all the things at one level that God was offering in terms of material prosperity and all those sorts of things, and actually Israel weren't doing bad. And if Ahab claimed that was because of Baal, maybe it was Baal that was bringing material prosperity. But tied in with that was also a sort of sensual license and a sexual license too that was actually quite attractive. Part of Baal worship meant going and having sex with a temple prostitute. That was part of the way you guaranteed rain for your particular crops. And you can see how that was at least attractive. It seemed to have your cake and eat it. Now, God certainly wouldn't have allowed that, but Baal worship did. And seemed to deliver all that God was going to deliver. But at the same time, they could see that living under Baal for this last 3.5 years hadn't been delivering quite what Ahab had promised, because there'd been no rain and there was famine. And last week we found Ahab wandering around looking for food for his horses, let alone for the people who were clearly starving as well. So whilst they had liked Baal when things seemed to be going well and all the license and liberty that brought, there was a question mark about whether it really worked. And Elijah had now pitched up on the scene, and, well, maybe, and they were wavering. But it's human nature, isn't it? We do want to have our cake and eat it if we possibly can. We'd like to have the two in the bush rather than the bird in the hand. And we're constantly being reminded that actually making a choice and living with one of those choices rather than trying to get both always has some wisdom attached to it. You and I can want to have our cake and eat it spiritually too. We can want to have all that God promises for eternity. And we may want also to buy into what the culture around us says delivers satisfaction and happiness and security and is fine. Come and enjoy it. We are. We might want to have our cake and eat it too. And so what is going on here is not completely alien to the pressures that we face in our own day. But let's see how it's resolved here. Because notice what's going on. We know, as we've been following the story, that there was no rain, and now there is going to be rain. And if Elijah pitches up and produces rain, but there's no demonstration particularly that that was God who let the rain happen, what are the people worshipping Baal going to say? And what's Ahab going to say? He's simply going to say, oh, of course, Baal has come back now from that distraction he had with the god Mot, who we saw a couple of weeks ago, who was always the reason why Baal couldn't deliver on his promises. Oh, there's rain. Good, Baal is back in operation again. So Elijah has to demonstrate before the rain comes that actually Baal is no god at all, and God really is God. Otherwise, when the event, the rain, happens, they will misinterpret its significance. And so Elijah says to them, I am the only one of the Lord's prophets left. Verse 22. Baal has 450. Shall we have a little contest? Let's get two bulls. You can choose whichever one you want. I'm not going to sort of present you with a bull that's already wired with explosive that will ignite. You know, no magician's trick here. You choose the one you want. We'll put them on wood and we won't set fire to the wood. And then you can call on the name of your God. And I'll call on the name of my God, and the God who answers by fire, well, he's God. It's worth noting at this point that in Israel's history, the two times that God has answered by fire for a sacrifice, in a sacrifice, is at the inauguration of the tabernacle, where they set up worship after the exodus from Egypt, and at the inauguration of the temple. So distinct moments in Israel's history where God has demonstrated that things are going right by consuming an offering with fire. So Elijah's saying, shall we see if we can pull that off again then? It's not a common occurrence, but let's just see who really is God then. So Elijah says to the prophets, because the people say, okay, okay, we said nothing earlier, but you're going to do a demonstration. Okay, that will, if that works, we'll go for it. Elijah says, right, you choose the bulls, call on your name of your God, light the fire. And they call on the name of Baal from morning till noon. Oh, Baal, answer us, they shout. No response, no one answered, and they danced around the altar they'd made. So let's see what it is we're learning here about Baal. At noon, Elijah begins to taunt them, because they've been going all morning. Shout louder, he says. Surely he's a god. Perhaps he's deep in thought, or caught up in a conversation with Moth or some other god, and you need to distract him. Perhaps he's busy travelling, perhaps he's sleeping and might be awakened. So they shouted louder and slashed themselves with swords and spears, as was their custom, until their blood flowed. They're getting serious about this. Well, midday passed, and they continued their frantic prophesying. Notice frantic prophesying now. You can see the sort of the worry lines etched on their face. The sweat is dripping down. But until the evening sacrifice time, look at the end of verse 29. There was no response. No one answered. No one paid attention. Ultimately, when it came to the test, when Baal was asked to prove himself and deliver, Baal was nowhere to be found. The writer couldn't put it more clearly, could he really? No response, no one answered, no one paid attention. Now notice just along the way what we see about how Baal worship operates. It would be convenient, wouldn't it, if Baal worship, or the worship of something other than God, wasn't very demanding, because that would just make life very straightforward. But notice actually Baal worship is demanding. We're told here, aren't we, that they're quite used to this frantic prophesying. This whole business of cutting themselves and getting quite worked up about appealing to Baal was something that they did normally, as was their custom, we're told. So there's a sense in which Baal worship is actually quite demanding. And in that sense, there is a parallel for us in the terms of the way that we worship, perhaps not a god on a plinth like Baal was, but those other little gods that are essentially good things that God has given us that we have turned into the things we look for satisfaction and fulfillment and deliverance, whether that be work, whether that be material possessions, whether that be sexual fulfillment, whether it be any of those things. They are good gifts from God, but they can be turned into idols. And notice how they can be demanding of us. Be true of work, wouldn't it? Work promises a living by which we can secure our future financially and deliver a lifestyle that will be comfortable. But actually, work often demands almost our lives from us. And so whilst we say there's no real cost to this, I'm just working and it'll deliver this for my family, actually there is cost. It may produce costs for our families and relationships. It may just be costly in terms of our own physical health. So there is a sense in which our worship of those things other than God that we look to provide security and material resources and anything that God would otherwise provide can be demanding and can be like this for us. And yet we're prepared to let it be that for the sake of what it says it will deliver, but often it never does. Well, there is no response, there is no answer, and no one pays attention. So what do we learn as Elijah takes over, and what do we learn about the Lord? Have a look at verse 30. Elijah said to the people, look, come here to me. We've had a day of waiting for Baal to deliver. We've had a lot of frantic activity, but not a lot of response. let us at the end of the day come over to me. So they came to him, they repaired the altar of the Lord, he took 12 stones, one for each of the 12 tribes. In other words, he's taking them back to the God who had brought them to be a nation. He's reminding them of where they had come. He built the altar, he dug a trench around it. He arranged the wood, he cut the bull into pieces, laid it on the wood. So far, so good. But then Elijah does something extraordinary. He fills jar after jar with water. And then three times over, he asks them to pour the water on top of the sacrifice, absolutely soaking the wood. Now, if you've ever tried to light a fire with any of that wood you can buy from garages, you'll know it's a hopeless case because it's soaked through because it's been outside for most of the winter. Well, Elijah's just making sure the wood is absolutely soaked through so it won't light. A stray spark won't set this off. It won't be accidental if this takes light. And there's so much water left over that it's filled the trench around. Remember, this is at a time when there is a drought in the land. He's using water to make God, in a way, have to do something miraculous to demonstrate that he is really God. And then Elijah says this, O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, Lord, O Lord, answer me, so that these people will know, O Lord, that you are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again. And then the fire of the Lord fell and burnt up the sacrifice, the wood, the stones, and the soil. So it wasn't just the wood that took fire, this is stones that took light. It's soil that was consumed. This is a furnace of extraordinary proportions. This is like going to a steelworks and seeing, you know, where everything is consumed in the smelting pot. And when the people saw this, they fell prostrate, which is a wise thing to do before God. It's always the biblical response to a demonstration of who God really is. And they cried, the Lord, he is God. Not Baal, he's God, but the Lord, he is God. So what do we learn about the Lord from this? Because it's quite a contrast, isn't there, between what Elijah has to do and what the prophets of Baal had to do. First thing to recognise is numbers don't matter or are of no consequence to God. If you have to think about who gets the sort of the vote for the most popular religion or the one that most people think is a good idea, it's going to be Baal. Elijah says, I'm the only prophet. Well, there are 100 prophets tucked away in a cave, but they're not particularly active at the moment. There are 450 prophets of Baal. There are another 400 prophets around the Asherah poles who sat at Jezebel's table. That's sort of about 800 to 1. If you count the other 100 prophets who are a bit inactive at the moment, it's about 10 to 1, isn't it, pretty much? But the numbers don't matter to God. It doesn't matter how many people are appealing to him. It doesn't matter what the force looks like on the ground. The issue is, who is God? Well, that's a great encouragement, isn't it? If you look at the stats at the moment from the last census, I think in Anglican churches in London, it's about 1.7% of the population maximum attend Anglican churches. If you add in the black majority churches, it probably creeps up to around 5%, something like that. It's not much more than that. That's about 20 to 1, isn't it? And it's tempting to think that actually our culture has left Christianity behind, it's dismissed it, and it doesn't have an answer or anything to say into our modern world. Well, we need to remember, don't we, that numbers have never been the thing that matters. The thing that matters is whether God is God. It doesn't matter how many people follow the alternative way of finding fulfillment, happiness in a future. If God is God, then his way is the way to do it. Numbers are of no consequence. It doesn't mean numbers are unimportant to God. They are, but they don't matter in terms of whether it's true or not. Secondly, notice that no obstacle can stop God. See, we will think of all the things that will stop the advance of God's purposes and kingdom in our city, in this nation, in the world. We'll think of it in terms of political forces that might stop it. We'll think of it in terms of cultural pressures. We'll think of it in terms of, well, there's a whole range of things we might say will stop the good news of Jesus advancing. And we can convince ourselves, therefore, that we're not going to make much progress, that there isn't much progress to be made. And yet we're reminded here, isn't it, that Elijah almost put obstacles in the way to show that obstacles don't matter to God. He is able to turn even the hardest of hearts to Jesus Christ, to soften it and turn it back to him. And he does it through the message of the gospel. And it would be foolish to think anything else. But we can begin to think a bit like Obadiah did, living so long under Ahab's rule that actually Ahab's always going to win out. I can't imagine a way in which following God's going to win out in this situation. I just can't imagine it, and so therefore it can't be true. You'd have to say that you couldn't imagine how the fire was ever going to light. But it did, because God is God. The fact that we can't imagine a way forward doesn't mean to say that God is not able to do what he's promised. And notice thirdly that activity is no inducement for God. God isn't moved by the amount of noise we make or the amount of activity we do religiously. It didn't matter that these prophets sort of flagellated themselves and beat themselves up and frantically prophesied. There was no God who was going to answer them. Elijah simply had to pray and God answered. That doesn't mean to say God always answers our prayers in the way that we hope, but that he is capable of doing so. And in fact, the New Testament in Matthew 6 reminds us that we're not to pray like the pagans do, with many words, thinking that will persuade God. But we're to go into a quiet place and pray, because our Father sees in secret and will reward us when we do that. Great encouragement to personal prayer and Bible reading, isn't it? That actually God sees when we come to him, not with great fanfare or trumpeting of activity religiously, but simply saying, Lord, you alone can change this situation. And so I'm going to ask you. So what do we make of this? Well, let's have a look at where this passage goes now. Because after the sacrifice comes down, and after the people acknowledge that God is God, notice what happens. Elijah commanded them, seize the prophets of Baal, don't let anyone get away. They seized them, they brought them down to the Kishon Valley and slaughtered them there. That's the first thing we just ought to note as we go through. That feels, doesn't it, to our context and our culture as if Elijah is being vindictive, that God is not being gracious or merciful. And we are tempted to question whether God is doing the right thing at that point. I think we need to recognise here that that is probably not because Elijah has got things wrong, nor that God has got things wrong, but that possibly our understanding of what is appropriate is misplaced. It is probably likely that we have underestimated the offence and the horror of apostasy, that is, standing against God, to God. We tend to be, I suspect, because we've grown up in a Christian culture, a bit like Catherine Great in that famous saying where she simply says, oh God, he'll forgive me, that's his job. Well, opposition to God, of the like that was displayed by Ahab and the prophets of Baal, could only result in one thing, and that was judgment and the death of those prophets. And that's what we see being enacted here. And the Bible reminds us too that actually we will face judgment finally. And that actually the consequences of facing judgment without the saving death of Christ to stand between us and God is awful. And it's Jesus who tells us to not trivialise it and think it will be no problem. But I want to see where the passage goes, not to the prophets of Baal, but onwards. Because look where it goes after that. The prophets of Baal are killed, but then Elijah says to Ahab, go eat and drink, because there is the sound of heavy rain. There's rain on the way. My God is God, and my God says there will now be rain. So Ahab went to eat and drink. Elijah climbed, he bent down to the ground, he put his face between his teeth. Go and look towards the sea, he told his servant. He went and looked, there's nothing there. 7 times Elijah said, go back. The 7th time, a cloud as small as a man's hand is rising from the sea. So Elijah said, go and tell Ahab. Hitch up your chariot, go down before the rain stops you. And meanwhile, the sky grew black with clouds, the wind rose, a heavy rainstorm came on, and Ahab drove off to Jezreel. See the picture here? The picture here is of a God who provides wonderfully, restores life, and rain is a picture of that. We see in conclusion that God is the God who has a word that brings rain, in other words, brings life back into the land, brings life as it should be. The thing with the worship of Baal is it's promised life, hasn't it? And they've all gone after it, but it hasn't delivered. In fact, there's been famine and drought in the land for 3.5 years. And then God says, let there be rain, and there is rain. The rain that makes the land flowing with milk and honey, that makes the land a pleasant land to be in. Because that is what God is in the business of doing, of providing a great future for his people. But the question is, of course, who will we trust for that life and life to the full? Will we still waver thinking, I'll keep God for eternity, but for the time being, I think a full life is to be found in pursuing everyone else tells me is brilliant? Or do I instead say, no, I trust God, and actually the way he has ordered for life is the way that actually brings life to the full, that brings joy and freedom and right relationships between people? That's the question, isn't it? The picture here is of the God who brings rain again, who brings life as he said he would bring life. Now the people were wavering, weren't they? They were saying, where shall we go? And you may think at the end of this, well, yeah, I ought to be trusting God. And I can see those times when perhaps I put my trust in the good things that God has given me, but I turn them into idols. But I don't know how I can turn away from them. Notice what the passage tells us. In Elijah's prayer, he says this, answer me, O Lord, so that they will know that you are God and that you are turning their hearts back again. The wonderful picture of this passage is that this whole event on Carmel is part of God's way of turning his people's hearts back to him. He knows they can't do it themselves. That's what it should be doing for us today. It's reminding us of who really is God and exposing the futility of going after other gods, of wavering. But we don't have just Mount Carmel. We, of course, have the cross and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. We have one of the greatest demonstrations of God's character, his love and faithfulness to his promises and his great power in defeating that which seems undefeatable, death. You and I need hearts that are shaped and turned back to trusting in God, not trusting in all the world offers. The New Testament encourages us not to be double-minded people, not to waver in James. But it is God who will do that for us. So our response today is not to go and say, I need to trust in God more. But it is to turn to the God who is able to break through every obstacle and say, Lord, my heart feels like the obstacle. Will you turn my heart back to you? Will you cause me to see through the empty promises of the idols in the world that I put my trust in? Will you do that through your word? Through this account on Mount Carmel, through the account of Jesus' death and resurrection, as I come to your word, perhaps that's another reason why it's worth coming to God's word day by day. Because that's the way he uses to move our hearts back to him. If we ignore his word day by day, well then the idols of this world will have a stronger voice and they will pull us away. But if we let God speak into our hearts, wonderful joy, he will turn our hearts back to him. Let's pray, shall we? And ask